to bring in the bill. I do say, however, that it is necessary to do something to get the Fox off dead center and to see whether the enemy continue to want to use the Fox on the front and whether they don't negotiate. When they're ready, we're ready. But we're not going to continue to allow them to use this forum for the purpose of bullying the United States in a propaganda forum rather than in seriously negotiating peace as we try to do, as exemplified by not only our private contact with 12 leaders that discussed on January 25th, but also on our speech of January 25th, which I made a very forthcoming offer.
Was there any link between the IGT antitrust settlement and contributions to San Diego as a convention city? And do you think that Mr. Kleindienst will be approved, confirmed as the Attorney General?
Well, I know that you ladies don't have been pressing on this matter, as you should, that this matter of very interesting sentiment in the nation. I will simply limit my remarks to these observations. First, Mr. Kleindienst is being considered for, as you've indicated, confirmation of the Attorney General of the United States. That's the purpose of the hearing. I had confidence when I appointed him that he was qualified for this position. I still have that confidence. I believe that he should be confirmed, and I believe that he will be confirmed. Now, as far as the hearings are concerned, there's nothing that's happened in the hearings to date. There is one way of getting my confidence in Mr. Kleindienst as a able, honest man, fully qualified to be a member of the United States. However, I'm not going to comment on any aspect of the hearing, any aspect of the case, while the Senate is still conducting, and while the Senate is still trying to determine the authenticity of the evidence that was before. That's a matter for the Senate committee, and the Mr. Eason, to continue to consider. I would ask for these hearings. We want the whole record brought out, because as far as he's concerned, he wants to go in as Attorney General with no cloud over it. He will not have any of my opinions once the hearing is concluded. And what we're talking about will be proved rather than simply charges, which is dead and unsubstantial.
Mr. President, I follow on that. Another aspect, which I think is not directly related to the ICC case, I wonder if you could give us your view on the proper role of White House staff members in contact with executive departments and regulatory agencies concerning matters that are before those departments or agencies. My specific reference, of course, is to the involvement of Mr. Flanagan in some of these matters. But I wonder if you could give us on a more general basis what you think is the proper role and the limits of that role for presidential aid in dealing with regulatory and law enforcement matters.
Well, a presidential aide must listen to all those who come to the White House, as they do in great numbers, on all sides of all cases, with regard to complaints that they have or causes that they wish to work for, just as they go to the members of the House and the Senate and others in that connection. What is improper is for a presidential aide to use influence for personal gain, and to use influence in any way that would not be in the public interest. Now, as far as Mr. Flanagan was concerned, Mr. Ziegler responded to that charge at considerable length with my total authority, and his views represent mine. I have nothing further to say.
Mr. President, how do you expect the war on inflation to succeed without the cooperation of George Meade and his friends?
The war on inflation will succeed with their cooperation, as being possible, but without it necessary. And I think the best indication of the fact that it is succeeding is that as far as that part of the Consumer Price Index, which is made up of those items that are under control, as Mr. Stein pointed out in his briefing yesterday, the wage price controls have been effective. The only part of the Consumer Price Index, or the major part of the Consumer Price Index, which resulted in what we thought was a disappointing increase in prices, at least a one-month increase, was the food index. The food index, as we know, is not controlled. Now, insofar as that food index is concerned, We discussed that at considerable length at the cost of living the council yesterday. What we found is that it is a mistake and totally unfair to make farmers scapegoat for the high meat prices and the high food prices. Approximately a third of what prices are that the consumer pays in the grocery store or the supermarket, approximately is only a third of that amount is a result of what the farmer receives as farm income. The other two-thirds goes to middlemen, to retailers, and others. And our preliminary investigation of this situation shows that the spread between what the farmer receives and what the consumer pays in the grocery store or the supermarket has widened. It is too great. That is the reason why the cost of the price commission is on April the 12th, if you know, I think it was announced this morning, is going to conduct a hearing on this matter to determine whether or not the profit margins in this period have gone beyond the guidelines that have been laid down. I will simply say that as far as we are concerned, we can say that on the one hand, we're glad to see that looking at a six-month period, the rate of inflation has decelerated. On the other hand, we are disappointed at even a one-month figure in which the rate of inflation is at the level it was this time. We're particularly disappointed that the food component was as high as it was. That's why we welcome the action of the Price Commission looking into that component as to why it is. And then, in the event that those food prices do not start to move down, then other action will have to be taken. And I'm prepared for that, for other action taken. I've directed those who have responsibility in this field to see what action can be taken. But I would simply conclude by pointing out that to feel that the action that will be effective is to control or move on the one-third that which the farmer receives as income for what he sells is not the most effective way to do it. One little example that I can use, I think it's quite graphic. Secretary Connolly was discussing this matter in the cost of living council yesterday. He said that he'd been in Texas and had talked to a rancher who raised chickens. He asked him how much he got a dozen for eggs. He got 30 cents a dozen. A couple of days later, he got breakfast at Hotel Pierre in New York, and he ordered a couple of eggs for breakfast. It was $5 for two. That's at the rate of $30 a dozen. Now, of course, the eggs have to be transported. They have to be processed. They have to be cooked. They have to be served. But 30 cents a dozen to the farmer and $30 a dozen to whoever buys those eggs in a restaurant, that's just too much. And we're going to get at that middleman one way or another.
Mr. President, would you give us your views on the general proposition of large political contributions, either by corporations or individuals, in terms of possibly getting something back?
Nobody has any impact as far as the general contributions are concerned. In this administration, as a matter of fact, I think some of our major complaints business people have not received the consideration that perhaps they thought that an administration that was supposed to be business-oriented would provide for it. As far as such contributions are concerned, they should always, of course, comply with the law. Second, as far as those who receive them are concerned, they must be accepted with no understandings expressed or implied that anything is to be done or as a result of those contributions that would not be done in the ordinary course of events. Let me just say on that point that looking at ITT, which, as I understand, has been a contributor to a number of political causes over the years, it's significant to note, and I hope that the members of the press will report this, I haven't seen this in many stories, it's significant to note that ITT became the great conglomerate that it was in the two previous administrations primarily. The Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, it grew, and nothing was done to stop it. In this administration, we moved from ITT. We're proud of that record. We moved on effectively. We required the greatest divestiture in the history of the antitrust law. And secondly, also, as a result of the consent decree, required that ITT not have additional acquisitions good settlement. It was a very good settlement. And I think under the circumstances, that gives a lie to the suggestion. This administration, in the handling of the IGT case, just using one example, was doing a favor for IGT. If we wanted to do a favor for IGT, we could just continue to do what the two previous administrations had done. That is nothing. The IGT continued to grow. But we moved on and moved effectively. Mr. McLaren, justifiably, very proud of that record. Dean Griswold, very proud of that record.
Mr. President, can we discuss your speech the other night and the moves on the problems of the schools for the blacks in our society? There are those who feel that in the comedy of the constitutional issue that has been raised and which you've asked that the courts have a moratorium, and at the same time, by putting more money into black schools, what you are doing, in effect, is going back to the old doctrine of separate but equal facilities for blacks. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I see that charge has been made, and I can see how that understanding and misunderstanding could evolve. But let me explain what we were trying to do, and what I believe our proposals, if they are enacted to the Congress, will accomplish. In the first place, we have to analyze what the constitutional problem is. The Constitution, under the 14th Amendment, provides for equal protection of the law. The Constitution does not provide as a remedy, fussy, or any other device. The Constitution in the 14th Amendment expressly grants power to the Congress to determine the remedies to accomplish the right of equal protection of the law. Now, we turn on a busing, and let me relate this to Brown versus the Board of Education. Brown versus the Board of Education, as its name indicates, was about primarily education. Brown versus the Board of Education held, in effect, that legally segregated education was inherently inferior education. I agree with that. On the other hand, how do we desegregate and thereby get better education? And here is where busing compounds the evil. Busing, for the purpose of achieving racial balance, not only does not produce superior education, it results in even more inferior education. And so what I was trying to do was to tackle the issue by saying we can and should have desegregation, but we should not compound the evil of a dual school system, of legal segregation, by using a remedy which makes it even worse. That's why I have concluded that first a moratorium on busing for a year was the right move to make. I believe it was going to be the moratorium was constitutional. I believe it was so held, it will be so held by the Supreme Court due to the fact that it deals with a remedy, not a right. That's the fundamental difference. Lawyers will disagree on that. The court will decide. I think the court will decide that the moratorium is constitutional. And that is why also I move in another case. When we talk about education, we must remember that if we had busing at the maximum degree suggested by the most extreme proponents of busing, it will still leave the vast majority of black school children living in central cities, going to what are basically inferior schools. A lost generation, as I described. And I decided that we could not allow that situation to continue without trying to move on it. How we tried to move? We tried to move through a program which has not yet been fully tested. I am not sure that it will work, but we've got to do something. And that is in the field of compensatory education. A program in which we, rather than doing it with a shotgun approach, which has proved ineffective, that we use the critical mass approach, $300, which is for the purpose of improving education in those schools where no plan for desegregation that anybody has suggested will ever affect. We cannot leave those people, those students there,
without having some action and some attention paid to it. One other thought with regard to this whole matter of compensatory education. I noted on one of the networks, not yours, but NBC, a very thoughtful series to the effect that compensatory education is a failure. We looked into that. As a matter of fact, when on the basis in which it's been used up to this point of a shotgun approach, where you have $100, $150, $200 a person, a student, it has not worked. You have an example in the District of Columbia where over $300 has not helped. On the other hand, in California and in four other states which came to our attention, we have found that there is substantial evidence to indicate that if we can get $300 a student or more into those schools, it will raise the level of education in those areas. That is why we are going down this road. Another point I should cover, incidentally, since the subject has been raised, is the matter of new money. Let me say there is certainly a great deal of new money in this program. First, you must remember that the Congress has not yet passed and has not yet sent to my desk a request for $1 billion in emergency school aid funds that I've asked for. That $1 billion will go to this program. And second, we have asked not only that $1 billion come here, but that the program be 4 years rather than simply 1 year, because our proposal, as you know, is simply a one-shot proposal for $1.5 billion. So that means you have $2.5 billion in new money. I would say in conclusion, I would like to be able to assure everybody here that this program of compensatory education, concentrating money in some of these areas on students who will never be helped by any program of busing at all, no matter how extreme, I would like to say that it will succeed. I am not sure, but I do know that we cannot go on with the present situation where we leave them there, growing up in inferior schools with no chance for hope. And Schultz believes, and others, experts that I've talked to, this critical mass approach will get us progress. I just want to say, however, that segregation, as far as segregation, desegregation is concerned, this administration has made great progress in desegregation. There are more black students that go to majority white schools in the South than in the North at the present time. Dual school system virtually eliminated. What we were trying to get at is the problem of busing. Busing, which is a bad name because it compounds the evil which Brown versus the Education was trying to get at. And also, it poisons the relations between the races. It creates racism. And it's time for somebody to move on it in what I thought was a responsible way.
Yes, President, to go back to the IEPs, our case for a minute. Since you have said that you see nothing improper in Mr. Flanagan's activities in various cases, would you permit him to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee if he is invited to do so?
Mr. Digger answered that question. I will not respond for that.
Mr. President, would you care to comment on the primaries, and do you expect Congressman Ashworth to go right down to the wires to convention in the
I realize that a lot of you have political questions that you may remember. I think the first president of the press club I ever introduced at one of their meetings many, many years ago, that I stated several months ago that in presidential press conferences, I would not answer questions on partisan political matters until after the Republican convention. That includes the Republicans, that includes the Democrats, that includes those who may leave the Republicans or the Democrats.
And it is still your intention, Mr. President, not to campaign until after convention time.
It is. As a matter of fact, I will not be making any political speeches, you may call them political, but I'm going to say I will not be appearing at the Warren before any partisan political groups making partisan political speeches, and I'm not going to ask any partisan political questions one way or another in a presidential conference or in any other forum of this kind. Between now and the Republican convention, I shall continue to be responsibility of the President of the United States, and I'll answer all questions in that area. I will not answer political questions. I'll have plenty of time to answer them after the Republican
convention. President, how do you assess the military situation in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, and will you be able to follow your schedule for withdrawal of troops and perhaps tell us something more about it?
I will not tell you more about the
withdrawal at this time, you know, we make these announcements at the time that they are scheduled and on the basis of the situation as it exists then. Another announcement will be made before the 1st of May. Second, with regard to our program for withdrawal, it has gone well, as you know. The casualties again were low this week. Still not zero, which is our goal. Two is better than 200 and 300, which is what it was when it came in. As far as the military situation is concerned, an ominous enemy buildup continues. The press has very well reported the threats to the Laotian base of Guantan. There have been some sporadic mortar attacks in Cambodia, and there have been a considerable amount of action in South Vietnam. On the other hand, I have gotten a report from General Abrams just a few days ago. He says that they still expect, he doesn't guarantee it, but he says they are still prepared for some attacks in this dry season. They have not come yet. He says if they do come, he is confident that the South Vietnamese will be able to contain them, and he's also confident that while the South Vietnamese lines, in the event the attacks are heavy, may bend, that they will not break. If this is the case, if this should be the case, it will be the final proof that Vietnamization has succeeded.
Mr. President, to be satisfied yourself, sir, that the Justice Department acted properly in quadrant committee about the investigation of campaign contributions to San Diego last year.
I've covered that question.
Mr. President, he spoke to Justice Buckley a minute ago and said that the patterns of living, Ruth calls out it. Have you then thought of some kind of new programs to try to break up the patterns that keep the blacks in the inner city, to try to get integration that way?
Well, it's very difficult to find an institutional program. Many have been suggested, and I imagine they're not any of them to be classified as new. The breaking up of these patterns is something that probably is going to occur over a period of time as economic considerations and educational considerations come more into play. I am confident of this, that we cannot put, as I said, not in my statement on busing a few days ago, but in my statement, the original statement on the whole educational process last year, we cannot put the primary burden for breaking up these patterns on the educational system. The purpose of education is to educate. And whenever a device is used to desegregate, which results in inferior education, we're doing a grave disservice to the blacks who are supposed to be helping.
Mr. President, is it a pragmatic observation that the world now is divided into three parts, the United States, China, and the Soviet Union?
Some would perhaps describe the world that way, but I think the world's much bigger and much more complicated. I don't think that you can rule out by such a simplistic observation the future of Latin America, the potential in Africa, the potential in South Asia and the rimland of Asia, the future of Japan, which is an economic giant even though it's a main military power. At the present time, it could be said that the United States and the Soviet Union are the two major superpowers from a military standpoint, that the People's Republic of China is the most populous nation in the world with the potential of becoming a superpower. Therefore, anyone who is interested in trying to build a structure of peace must deal with these with the relationships between these three great power centers now. I think that is the key to the future. But we must also, at the same time, have policies that look to the future of Japan, the future of Western Europe, because it will play a major role, and of course the future of Latin America.
Mr. President, sir, you have a sort of a pattern of making peace with enemies around the world. Are you next going to see Fidel Castro?
Oh, I haven't been invited.
Mr. President,
Mr.
You have a comment, sir, on the recommendation of your commission on drugs that the use of marijuana in the home be no longer considered a crime?
I met with Mr. Schaefer. I read the report. It is a report which deserves consideration for receiving. However, as to one aspect of the report, I'm in disagreement. I was before I read it, and reading it did not change my mind. I oppose the legalization of marijuana, and that includes its sale, its possession, and its use. I do not believe you can have effective criminal justice based on the philosophy that something is half legal and half illegal. That is my position, despite what the commission has recommended.
Mr. President,
on your short account, you intend to try to do something about getting us in a better trade position. Also, you intend to take up the matter of cleaning up the Great Lakes.
We're working out the agenda for our meeting at the present time. I would have to say quite candidly that we've had very little success to date in our negotiations with our Canadian friends, which shows that that way that sometimes you have more problems negotiating with your friends than with your adversaries. But that is as it should be. They have a right to their position, we have a right to ours. But we will discuss certain trade, we will discuss the Great Lakes environment, and I am sure we will also discuss the world situation in which Prime Minister Trudeau has some, based on my previous visits with him, some very constructive ideas to suggest. In addition to my trip to Canada, I will, of course, brief Prime Minister Trudeau personally on the results of my visit to China, and also brief him prior to my going to the Soviet Union on my visit to the Soviet Union. I think it is a very helpful thing that at this point we are meeting with our friends from Canada, although we will find that we have some very basic disagreements probably after the meeting.
That's right. Sir, when you went to China, there were a lot of people in this country who sincerely hope that your trip would be helpful in terms of settling the Vietnam War in some fashion or another. Did you find this trip helpful in that respect, and if so, could you tell us how?
Time that we went to China, I indicated that the purpose of that trip was to discuss relations between the two countries, and its purpose was not to discuss the situation with regard to other nations. Now, as far as the discussions that did take place, the agenda did include the whole range of problems in the world in which the People's Republic of China are interested. As we are interested. As far as Vietnam is concerned, I don't think it would be helpful to indicate what was discussed, what was not discussed. Only time will tell what was going to happen.
Mr. President, there's been some question raised about Ambassador Watson's qualifications to negotiate with the Chinese in Paris. Do you still have confidence in his ability to negotiate exchange agreements with the Chinese?
Mr. Lissador, the best test of that, in my opinion, is how the negotiations are going. They're going very well. Mr. Watson is conducting them with great confidence, and I understand total sobriety. And I realize that there are those who raise questions about the personal conduct of the ambassador when he travels to his post. I see that some members of the House and Senate are raising such questions about it, that I would say the people in glass houses shouldn't look so. Security of the United States and what was best for this country in dealing with its adversaries abroad, stood firm. On the other hand, in this particular area, I think Mr. Meany, I respectfully say, is overstepped. In the latter part of the 19th century, this country determined that no business leader could take the attitude of the public be damned. And in the latter part of the 20th century, that applies to both business leaders and labor leaders. Mr. Meany, in this case, I'm sure thinks he's acting in the best interest of his members. But I would respectfully suggest that I believe that a great number of his members, possibly the majority, realize that wage increases that are eaten up by price increases are no wage increase at all. They will also remember, as they look at the fair income, that in the past 6 months since phase two began, we have increased in real wages, something that we have not had for 5 years before that time, in any significant degree. And while we have had this 1 month of bad figures, and believe me, I'm not satisfied with bad figures. I want these food prices down. Nevertheless, our wage price controls are working. We are going to reach our goal, in my opinion, very much sure, of cutting the rate of inflation in half. And even though Mr. Meany is not with us, I think what we do will be in the best interest of his members, and I hope in the end, maybe he'll invite me to breakfast.
Mr. President, excuse me.
I'm sorry, I think you had it in.
With respect to Mr. Agnew, do you still not feel like breaking up the way you want?
Well, I covered that question in a rather lengthy discussion with Mr. Rather, sitting right in this room a few months ago. And my views are the same now as they were then.
Mr. President, I would like to ask one question for you. I assume the last time you were on the Fort County bus contract, you had said down the road, you still hope for having a strategic confrontation agreement to not only discuss, but hopefully sign.
Well, Mr. Temple, and I realize that there are, and I hope many of you will be able to go on that trip who went to the PRC, and many who didn't go to the PRC can also go. The Moscow trip at the present time will be very different from the PRC trip in the sense that it will be primarily devoted to a number of substantive issues of very great importance. One of them may be salt. If salt is not completed before Moscow, it does not appear now likely that they can complete salt before Moscow, because in my conversations with Mr. Smith, before he left Ambassador Smith, I find that while we are agreed on principle on the limitation of offensive and defensive weapons, that we are still very far apart on some fundamental issues. Well, for example, whether or not SLBM should be included, matters of that sort. And Mr. Smith went back to the meetings this time in Helsinki with very full instructions from me, both written and oral, to do everything that he could to attempt to narrow those differences. I believe there is a good chance at this point, particularly in view of Mr. Brezhnev's quite constructive remarks in his speech the other day, that we may reach an agreement on salt in Moscow on defensive and offensive limitations, and also agreements in a number of other areas. This is our goal, and I would say that at this time, the prospects for the success of this summit trip are very good. What year were you president, Jay?
55.
That's right. Well, remember, I was there for the inaugural party.
You were in the first
I didn't mention the other. The only other one that I think was Warren Francis. Remember Warren? When he died, I was on the conference table. I was vice president. And I think it was
I'd like to give my best to Bob.
I'm going to go to the Good luck.
Thank you.
Good broadcast, huh?
Really.
Appreciate your good work.
Thank you.